You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Terry Lenzner has been quite influential behind the scenes in Washington. He investigated Watergate and the Monica Lewinsky incident. He has been a pioneer in political opposition research. He has also written a memoir called The Investigator, which details the ins and outs of his 50-year career, where he says he's not interested in ideals, just the facts. I'm pleased that it brings him here to talk about it. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
And the book is published by Blue Rider Press, I should point out. Early on, you were asked to cover anti-Vietnam War demonstrations, a special project given to you by Lyndon Johnson's Attorney General Nicholas Katzenbach. What did he want to know about the demonstrators?
That's a great question. And keep in mind that I was a year out of law school at this point, so I wasn't quite sure myself what the heck was going on.
But you were working in the Civil Rights Division.
Yes, I was.
Weren't you out there to defend the right of people to protest?
Exactly. Exactly. And I think I mentioned that in the book. I wondered why they asked me to do this when I was supposed to be defending people's rights and interests and human rights. But I think what they did was I had been in a lot of demonstrations and marches in the South, in Mississippi and Selma, Alabama. And they were looking for somebody who had experience and was quiet and discreet on those kinds of things.
Well, what can you find out from marching with other people? You're not going to ask them pointed questions, are you?
No,
hey, LBJ's got to go, or whatever they were saying at the time.
Well, as it turned out, the heads of the marchers were standing around in a circle across the street from the White House, and they were talking, you know, loudly so everybody could hear. I dressed like this, by the way. I didn't try to look like something I wasn't. And I told—
You mean a suit and tie?
Suit and tie. And I told Mr. Katzenbach, the Attorney General, that if anybody asked me what I was doing there, I was going to take out my identification from the Department of Justice and tell them I was here helping look at to make sure that we didn't have any violence or misappropriation. So I heard them start talking, and they were saying we're going to try to get a petition. We have the right to petition the President of the United States, and we want to petition the President of the United States. We're going to go up to the gate, and we're going to insist that the President or his representative come down and let us give them the petition under the Constitution. And so I called Mr. Katzenbach, which is what he wanted me to do, and I gave him this information. And he said, well, hold on a second. I'm going to call the White House. So he called somebody at the White House who I never knew who it was, and Mr. Katzenbach said, okay, tell the White House what you just told me. So I did that. And then he said, so what should we do? And again, I was just out of law school, so I thought they were saying, I was actually thinking to myself, this is really interesting. I'm just out of law school. I'm going to hear top people in the White House and the Attorney General talking about what to do in a crisis like this. This is a great lesson. And then Katzenbach said again, Terry, what should we do? You're there. And I went, holy smokes, the government's in trouble if they're asking me to give them advice on
you
this.
You suggested that they send a Johnson lookalike to accept the petition.
Did.
Was there one on staff?
Secret Service always has somebody that looks sort of like Johnson. It didn't make any difference who they sent. I just wanted them to accept the petition.
Did it work?
And it did work. They were very confused. They didn't expect that to happen.
Now, your descriptions of Washington in the 60s sound quaint compared to what's going on today. There was little security. Most government buildings were open to the public. And you say any neighborhood kid could just play in the hallways.
They came in and cycled all the time on their cycles.
And when did that change? 9/11? Or
yeah,
before
yeah,
that?
9/11. I think it started to change in the late 80s, but 9/11 certainly.
You were at the Justice Department during the implementation of the Voting Rights Act. Were you surprised by the recent Supreme Court decision?
I wasn't pleased by it. I was in Selma when Lyndon Johnson gave his speech that We Shall Overcome. And I must tell you, it was a very dramatic and emotional moment for me because I was driving through downtown Selma, empty streets all around me. I was alone in the car. And I just thought, I mean, that's really an incredible, moving statement. And it's great to hear that.
Do you think that Eric Holder and the Justice Department will be able to reestablish the preclearance requirement in states like North Carolina? Would they'd have to go through the courts.
Yes.
Would that be possible in the light of the Supreme Court decision?
Well, I'm not an expert on that, to be quite honest, but I would hope that they would do everything they could, both politically and publicly, to try to rectify that situation.
But then, in light of the current gridlock in Congress, is it likely that any new civil rights legislation would pass both houses?
I think, unfortunately, I'm not sure what anything that could be passing both houses at this point, no matter what the subject matter was.
So after that, you joined the U.S. Attorney's Office as a federal prosecutor. Did that represent a major culture change?
Only to this extent. Some of the people at the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District were pretty hard-nosed, and they were concerned. You've been working on behalf of African Americans. Are you going to be able to prosecute them, that kind of person, if you have a case involving them? I told them, of course I will, as long as it's, you know, reliable information.
But then you had to get the cooperation of the FBI, and J. Edgar Hoover was not the most He wasn't really much in support of civil rights.
That's an understatement.
So did he share information with you? Did you?
Well, here's what. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. I'm just doing a follow-up to that.
When I started in the Civil Rights Division, it was known that we had to be extremely careful when we gave the FBI an assignment. In fact, we ended up having to give them, if you ask this question and the answer is why, then follow up with this question, and so forth and so forth, which took a lot of time, and it was a distraction for us, but we had to do it because they wouldn't follow up if we didn't do that. And, you know, there was a, particularly for the local FBI people in Mississippi and Alabama, they had no interest in helping the United States government enforce the laws.
My guest is Terry Lenzner. He's written a memoir called The Investigator, 50 Years of Uncovering the Truth. You talk about how broad and powerful the scope of your authority was as a federal prosecutor. How did you make sure you didn't abuse your power?
Well, that's also a great question. And the fact of the matter is that it's extraordinary also that the U.S. Attorney's Office, at least in the Southern District of Newark, has never overreached. And I think that's primarily because of Bob Morgenthau. Because Morgenthau was so demon over not doing anything improper, not stretching our authority, but it was extraordinary because I could have subpoenaed anybody I wanted to.
Well, we have a sense today that the government has access to any information it wants, but my reading of your book would suggest that it was even easier when you were a federal prosecutor.
It was easier because
you could get somebody's Social Security number without having to go through any complicated processes.
Right. Well, you had to either serve a subpoena, and if somebody objected to the subpoena, which they could do, then you had to justify the service of the subpoena and get some answers as to why we were doing what we were doing.
You didn't really enjoy being a federal prosecutor?
Well, I did enjoy it for a while, but I frankly, because of the kinds of questions you're asking, I decided to move on when I had a chance, and I got into things that were, to me anyway, more interesting.
Well, now we have the new Nixon administration in place, and you were encouraged to take a meeting with Donald Rumsfeld, who was putting a staff together in the new Nixon White House. Were you, considering the politics you've suggested you had, were you apprehensive about working for Nixon?
Well, that event was triggered by John Doerr, who was the head of the Civil Rights Division and became a great leader for me and a great mentor. And he said, this is a great guy I think I had been fired by Rumsfeld by that time. And I take that back, that's wrong. That came later, but...
You were fired by Rumsfeld when you talked to the New York Times.
Yeah.
That's another story.
That's
we'll
another story,
that.
Right. And a lot of other things, by the way. That's not the only reason. But, when I was approached to do something, I went to see Rumsfeld, and he told me, I would say, what the hell are you doing, and you know, what do you want me to do? And he said, I'd like you to be my special assistant. So for 2 months, I was a special assistant as a consultant. And then he offered me three other jobs, and I decided I didn't want to be a special assistant, so I took over the legal service program, 2,000 lawyers representing the poor.
Well, did you understand what Rumsfeld was talking about all the time? Because I've been confused by some of his statements. Was he different when he was face-to-face with members of his staff than he was when he was talking to the press or to Congress?
I don't think he was that much different, to be frank. You know, he made a fetish almost when he was doing the war news conferences of talking about light things and moving around and different things. No, I think that I think he really believed that we could help people living in poverty with our lawyers.
Well, Tom Wicker once wrote a book in which he suggested that, ironically, Richard Nixon may have been our last liberal president.
Right.
Because of affirmative action and because of the Clean Air Act and a whole mm-hmm. bunch of other things that now are under attack by people on the right. Was it that your feeling? Because the other image we get of Nixon was of a bigoted man who really didn't have much respect for poor, for blacks, for Jews, all the sorts of things that would go against that whole concept of being a liberal president.
Well, that was true. We didn't know all that before the tapes came out, but I agree with you. And frankly, when Dorr called me and said, I'd like you to go down and see Rumsfeld, I said, John, are you telling me I should work for the Nixon administration? And John said, I'll never forget this, and he said, just do what I do, zig when everybody else zags. And so that's what I did. And I got into it, and it was a great education.
Well, the president of the American Bar Association came out and publicly warned against storms of protest and backlash from the legal service programs. Was that just bad press, or were people really unhappy?
The people that were really unhappy were Republican merchants, Republican congressmen, Republican senators, Republican governors. We were suing constantly, the governor of California, and we were
not Ronald Reagan.
Ronald Reagan.
Oh, that guy.
And we were winning big recoveries for the poor, and it was clear that that wasn't acceptable to the White House. In fact, I would get calls from Ehrlichman and Haldeman saying, you know that lawyer that just won that case against Reagan? Fire him. And I'd say, I can't fire him. I didn't hire him. But that was the attitude.
But then you got fired.
Yeah. Well, I decided I was not going to cross a line was led into compliance that didn't comply with the purpose of the statute to help people in poverty.
And as I mentioned earlier, you went to the New York Times.
I did.
Something that would get you into trouble today.
Yeah, sure.
What were you leaking?
No, I wasn't leaking anything. I had a meeting. I asked for a meeting with them because I knew that Rumsfeld was trying to dismantle the program. And I wanted the New York Times to write something about it to see if we could generate some leverage to stop him from doing what he was doing. And actually, it helped a lot.
My guest is Terry Lenzner, L-E-N-Z-N-E-R. He's written a memoir called The Investigator, 50 Years of Uncovering the Truth, that is published by Blue Rider Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. Later on in the show, we will look at the largely unknown role that German women played in the Holocaust. Plus, our gurus of how-to, Alan Larry Abell, will be taking your calls and questions on home repair. And here's a reminder that we're reading Peter Carey's Oscar and Lucinda this month for the Leonard Lopate Show Book Club. It's set in the 19th century in Australia, and this Booker Prize-winning novel follows Oscar and Lucinda as they discover that they share a guilty passion for gambling. It's a story of love and commerce, religion and colonialism that culminates in a crazy expedition to transport a glass church across the outback. Get your copy today, and your thoughts on the novel are welcome on our show page at WNYC.org. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. We're also available as a podcast. We are back with Terry Lenzner, who is the founder and chairman of Investigative Group International. He was assistant chief counsel to the Senate Watergate Committee and began his career as a Justice Department attorney with the Civil Rights Division, also was federal prosecutor in the Southern District of New York. He's written a memoir called The Investigator, 50 Years of Uncovering the Truth. It is published by Blue Rider Press. You met Daniel Ellsberg when he was preparing for his case. What did you think of him?
Well, as the book notes, I had already tried the case for the Berrigans and won and basically saved them from probably life-term sentences for their anti-war efforts.
So you were working in private practice as an attorney?
Yes, I was at that time. That's absolutely correct. And that was a terrific case, and I liked them a lot. I loved them a lot. And it was terrifying because when you are so bound in with the clients and you don't want anything bad to happen to them, you really have to fight and fight and fight. So when we won that case, I was, of course, exhilarated. And it was a great triumph for us because the Department of Justice had every plus. They put it into a venue that had a lot of war munitions companies and stuff like that. So I was asked to go see Dan in California because he wanted me and his people wanted me to help them in his case. And I got out there, and he was staying at a mansion overlooking, I guess, Beverly Hills or something. Oh, I'm sorry.
You said you're sorry because you're banging the table.
I can't stop.
People in the audience are going crazy.
I'm sorry. All right, I'll go back.
So you went to this mansion.
I went to this mansion.
He had a technique for safekeeping documents by giving them to friends. Did you think that was a good practice?
I didn't think that was a good practice at all, particularly since a lot of them were girlfriends. And the first one I met was a Swedish woman. And I said to her, "What's your status here?" And she said, "Oh, I'm on a visiting pass." And I said, "Well, you know, you're very vulnerable because the government could use that as a leverage." And then I went over to Dan because he was talking to his co-conspirator, and he was telling the co-conspirator all the people that he had given the documents to. And I went over there and I said, "Look, guys, this is not wise because the co-conspirator had been given immunity. And he had to testify. And if he had to testify, then he had to disclose what Dan was telling him. And if he didn't testify, he'd go to jail for 18 months. So I suggested that they ought to stop that. And they basically shrugged me off and said, "You don't know what you're talking about. We know what we're doing." And they just, that was the end.
So you decided not to handle the case.
That's correct.
You applaud how Ellsberg portrayed himself in the media, though. How good a job has Edward Snowden done?
Well, that's a great question. I'm no expert on...
People have compared the
yes,
situations.
I know. Because he's not in person here in the United States, I think that's a detriment. Because I don't see how people can be sympathetic to an individual who's not in the United States, who's not coming to the United States, who's not back to defend himself from the United States and to disclose or to personally defend himself and give us a reason.
Well, as a lawyer, do you think he has good reason to fear coming to the United States?
Oh, I think he does, yeah. I absolutely do.
Moving right along, you were involved in the Watergate investigation from the beginning. How do you go about conducting such a high-profile congressional investigation? Where do you start?
Well, we started with what we knew, which was not very much, but there had been a trial of the burglars. And we had some information from that trial, although it wasn't particularly significant. So what I did was I had my staff identify everybody at the Republican National Committee, the Committee to Reelect the President, CREEP, senior officials in the Department of Justice and other locations, and to get to identify them, to identify the people that work for them. Because we discovered over the years that people who are secretaries or lesser important people don't exist in the minds and the vision of senior people who are, you know, way over, much more important in their minds than the people we're talking about.
But they are witnesses to what's going on.
Exactly.
And that's why you began by subpoenaing them, Yes. The low-level subordinates?
That's exactly right.
Did people start coming out of the woodwork to talk to you?
They did, actually.
Why do you think they did? Do you think that a lot of people were disturbed by what they had seen?
I do. I think people were disturbed. And when we get these calls, we'd see them, we'd go to a restaurant or a bar, and they'd say things like, I can't stand it. I have to tell you what's going on, and my conscience won't allow me to continue to not do something about this situation.
Were you the first person to realize that Nixon had tape-recorded conversations in the Oval Office?
No, I don't think I was the first person. I think we had a hint that he was taping things, because we found out from a Democrat that there was a taping system under Johnson. So we were asking every witness that we brought in just the standard question, do you know of any taping systems that are being utilized in the White House or anyplace else? And that's how that question came up.
Well, how long into the investigation did you really connect the burglary to the White House?
I don't remember specifically the month and date, but...
Were you into it for a while, or was this something that came along pretty quickly?
No, I think most of us assumed that the president and the senior officials in the White House were not going to be involved. It didn't, because it just was, it seemed crazy that they would have engaged in this kind of thing, break-ins and cover-ups of safes and banks and things like that. So I was shocked, and I was continually shocked as more and more revelations came out.
And you wound up delivering a subpoena to President Nixon?
Yes, I did.
What was his reaction?
Well, he wasn't. I served it on his lawyers. We had organized it so that they would allow us to get into the White House and serve it.
Well, they could have sent somebody who looked like Nixon, as you did with the Johnson situation. Terry Lenzner has written a memoir called The Investigator, 50 Years of Uncovering the Truth. It is published by Blue Rider Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You give lots of credit to Woodward and Bernstein's reporting. One member of your staff, Scott
Armstrong,
even helped Woodward break stories, and he wasn't Deep Throat.
No, he wasn't. And he wasn't supposed to be. He was on the staff, and he wasn't supposed to be giving information to anybody in the media. There was a rule in the committee.
Well, there's always a rule of not leaking information,
right.
But Washington is a town where leaking is constant.
I learned that.
Worse
totally
than my faucet in the bathroom.
I'll tell you a funny story on that, if I could, just very briefly. I was doing a executive session with General Haig on the question of the Hughes-Rebozo money. And when I got back to my office, the phone rang, and it was the New York Times saying, we understand General Haig took the national security exemption 45 times. And I said, I can't comment on that. And then I ran back to Weicker's office, and I threw open the door, and I said, Senator, I insist on talking to you about this. We can't continue to have these leaks. And he stood up, he's a very tall man, and he looked down on me, and he said, who elected you to the Senate? And I said, well, that's a good question, actually. Kind of shrunk me. And then he went through, and this was interesting, he went through an explanation of why he was doing the leaking. And his justification, which I finally turned around and agreed with, was we have to keep the public apprised of what's going on.
On the other hand, doesn't it undermine your ability to build the case?
Yes.
Because certain things will be thrown out of court.
Well, not only that, but it gives the potential targets that haven't been interviewed a sense of where we're going and what we're going to be asking them.
How did it affect the hearings that they were televised?
I don't think it was as big a deal as I expected, to be honest with you. We got pretty used to the cameras very quickly, and a lot of the younger people would hang around trying to get into on the TV during the recesses. But I didn't have time to do that because we had constant scheduling things and witnesses and all that.
It was a different time. There was bipartisanship on the committee. We don't see that much anymore. Do you think that could happen today? Did things change when Bill Clinton was being impeached, or more recently when people have called for the impeachment of President Obama?
I think that things changed back to where they had been before this bipartisan, nonpartisan model was utilized by Irvin and Baker and in the House of Representatives. And I think that's probably the last major investigation that will ever be sort of nonpartisan without all the flavor and bitterness.
Now, if you ask most people who authorized the break-in, they probably would say, well, that was never determined. But you say that they were answered during the Watergate Committee investigation. It's just that the public doesn't seem to know that. Why?
Well, for one thing, it was a very complicated case, we had a lot of information that we wanted to get out, but we didn't. The committee didn't want to. I mean, there was an assassination attempt that was being worked on with Howard Hughes and Bibi Rebozo and a whole bunch of other significant figures, and Hank Greenspun, who was the head of the Las Vegas Sun. When I went to see him, he said what they really wanted was these memos from Howard Hughes to Robert Mayhew for the cash that was being given to Rebozo for the president's properties, to improve the president's properties. And I thought that could have been the end of the game. But we never got a chance to. They never complied with the subpoenas, and we never got a chance to finish it.
And what about that assassination attempt? Who was going to be the victim?
Castro.
Which has come out, although maybe not that specific incident.
Not that specific. And actually, just to fill the facts, they were going to use Johnny Roselli and
a mob guy and
Giacano, both of whom were mob guys. And so you got to think, what were they thinking?
You interviewed Rosemary Woods, Nixon's secretary, about the 18-minute gap, and you say she didn't strike you as the kind of person who made mistakes. Does that mean that you don't think the gap was an accident?
No, I don't think the gap was an accident.
Do you believe, in the book you say you think that Nixon ordered the break-in. Why didn't he just have the tape destroyed?
I think the only possible reason for that was that he wanted to keep, believe it or not, the material for tax reasons, that he could use them to get, write-offs and stuff like that.
You had met him when you were working for Rumsfeld. What
yes.
was your impression of him at the time?
Well, the first time I met him was in the Oval Office with Rumsfeld, and he spent a lot of time talking about how people in the in the northern regions in Europe committed suicide more often than people in America. So that left me a little wondering how cogent he was.
And you say that you were most amazed by the depth of his paranoia. Is that because of the enemies list or other things as well?
Well, the primary piece of evidence I have for that is in February of 1969, Ehrlichman ordered Tony Ulasewicz, who was a bag man and also the creator of the enemies list, to go to New York and hire a bunch of other people to work on the enemies of the president. And that was a consistent theme. Now, when you think back to the chronology of that, that was February 69. They hadn't even gotten into the White House, into their offices. And so that was a preordained strategy, and they just went straight at it.
You say that Nixon's dirty tricks were worse than the usual political games. What did he do to sabotage Muskie's campaign?
Well, he actually, it was a brilliant, I have to say this for them, it was a brilliant strategy because they were having people infiltrate the Democratic candidates' campaigns, steal documents, circulate the documents, and claim that one of the other candidates did it. And they were trying to create an uproar between the candidates so they would fight among themselves. And then, of course, the Muskie letter, the famous Muskie letter, ended his campaign. So their process worked.
Isn't stealing illegal? I know you suggested that those kinds of tricks would be made a federal crime, and it never got anywhere. But stealing is stealing, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, but nobody ever prosecuted.
I don't think so.
Now, you're in opposition research. That's the same sort of thing that leads to dirty tricks, isn't it?
No, I don't think so. Not at all. When we did opposition research for Senator Kennedy when Romney was running against him, we looked at the situation. We were asked to do some research on Romney. I looked at it as Romney was claiming that he was a great businessman, and I said to the people in charge of the campaign, he's claiming he's a great businessman. let's do an assessment of that. Let's see if that's an accurate statement, because that's what he's running on. And I thought that was fair game. And when we looked into it, we found the whole Bain Capital business.
It became an issue in the last presidential campaign as well. He accused you at the time, or your firm anyway, of being sleazy, but then later he hired you.
Yes,
didn't he
did. He? Yes, he did.
I guess all's fair in love and politics.
I can't answer that question. I don't know what's fair.
You also got some heat for defending Dr. Sidney Gottlieb.
Mm-hmm.
He's best known for his involvement with the CIA program called MKUltra.
Ultra, right.
How did you know you could trust him?
I made an assessment of him when I first met him in the park, which is the first meeting we had. And since he was with the CIA, we had to, on his orders, we had to meet somewhere that nobody could see us. But I got to know him very, very well. I got to know his family very well. And I concluded that he was a patriotic American and that I could trust him. And he wasn't going to do anything that was harm either me or the country.
Well, in that case, the CIA used national security as a blanket mm-hmm. to cover anything that they might embarrass them. But perhaps one of the most embarrassing things we remember of recent history was Monica Lewinsky. You got involved in that investigation? In what way?
I was asked to do some research. My company was asked to do some research on some of the people involved in it. It was basically a due diligence research. We do that all the time for different clients. And we do a public search. We do a search of public records. And based on that search, we provide the client with the results of the thing.
And you did that research into Monica Lewinsky?
I don't know. I'm not sure we did do that on Monica Lewinsky.
What about Paula Jones?
I don't think we did Paula Jones either.
Because people were calling you a part of Clinton's secret police.
Yes, wasn't that silly?
Are you on a retainer for Hillary 2016?
No, I'm not.
Okay, well, we've pretty much run out of time.
Okay.
But tell me, was Lee Harvey Oswald the sole Kennedy assassin?
I wasn't present at that situation, and I never investigated it. So I'm sorry, I can't really answer that question.
It's the only reason I had you on the show, Terry. Terry Lensner, his book, The Investigator, 50 Years of Uncovering the Truth, is published by Blue Rider Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for inviting me.